so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, literally the house of wine, and his banner over me was love. Sustained me with cakes of raisins, refreshed me with apples, for I am lovesick. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Reuters News Service reported on June the 6th of this year, romance and marriage are out, while casual sex and low-commitment relationships are in among young Americans, researchers said. A study by Rutgers University's National Marriage Project found that young men and women in their 20s, unlike generations before them, aren't interested in finding marriage partners when they date. Instead, they are more concerned with sex without strings and relationships without rings. Today's singles scene is not oriented toward marriage, nor is it dedicated to romantic love as it has been in the past, said David Pompano, co-director of the National Marriage Project and a sociology professor at Rutgers in New Jersey. To be sure, he says, young Americans today did not invent the concept of free love such as existed during the 1960s. The difference is that young people today are more concerned with economic and sexual self-gratification than past generations. In other words, they're more interested in making money and simply having fun. But we must also note that they have been somewhat scarred by the divorce culture that has preceded them. That's why in this report we discovered they favor living together as a tryout for marriage or even as an alternative to marriage. They believe sex is for fun and has no strings attached. And they have a fear of divorce and see marriage and divorce as a potential economic liability. But then the article goes on to point out something rather fascinating, I think, which reveals something that is deep within the soul of every person. Oddly, however, most of the young men and women who participated in the study expected someday to meet and marry someone who fulfilled their emotional and spiritual needs. However, there's a major problem with what is going on, and note, the problem, researchers said, is simply this, that their current mercenary mating habits, how do you like that for a modern term? Their mercenary mating habits do not easily lead to the fulfillment of that goal. Barbara Defoe Whitehead said the men and women in the study, because of the high incidence of divorce among their parents, did not count on having lasting relationships with each other. Instead, they focused more on themselves. And she concludes the article by saying, we may be seeing a massive change that would mean that romantic love and courtship might be giving way to something altogether new, or we may be in a period of cultural cluelessness. And I think that's perhaps a more insightful assessment and diagnosis. We are indeed, when it comes to marriage today, in a period of cultural cluelessness. Indeed, the article does not have much by way of encouragement. It is rather a tragic and realistic picture of the mating and marriage scene today. However, a second article that appeared just a couple of weeks ago in USA Today, September the 11th, by Iris Casnall of the Washington, actually in the Washington Post, I think puts all this together as she was writing a commentary on the blockbuster hit on HBO that has won a number of awards entitled Sex and the City. And she writes this article in evaluating the show, but she titles the article Being Single But Seeing Double. And listen to what she wrote. I think you'll find this fascinating, and I'll just read it. I'm looking at the recent Time magazine cover that pictures the four buffed stars of HBO's Sex and the City, women who talk dirtier and have more sex than anyone I have ever met. Front and center is Sarah Jessica Parker with her tumbling locks of hair, perfectly highlighted and curled, falling to her breast, encased in a white strapless gown. Her lips are glossed into an iridescent purple pout. The look in her cat green eyes says, "Take me now." Decked out for an evening of prowling, these women appear to be appropriate cover art for an article titled, "How to Snag a Mate." Instead, the Sex and the City sirens are a tease for a story which goes more like this: "Who needs a husband?" Which points to a growing trend defined this way: more women are saying no to marriage, and more women are embracing the single life. But then Iris raises a question: are they happy? And listen to what she writes. Happy is not among the first words that come to mind. They are clearly stunning on the outside, but they do not exude real joy from within. And any single woman who has been dating too long and too much can tell you why. Sex in the city feels good for fleeting moments, but it's no ticket to a satisfaction that endures. And there lies the ancient reason why most Americans still choose to get married. Being single is lonely. Humans need long-term companionship. Most women don't want intimacy on the fly with a carousel of lovers. Most women want to finally find a partner who looks beyond the bottle gold fibers of highlighted hair and into the fiber of their being. Most women want to be able to skip, I like the way she says this, only a woman could, most women want to be able to skip shaving their legs once in a while and still feel beautiful in the eyes of their men. And what is she saying? She's just simply saying this: deep down where it really counts, men and women have not changed. They're looking for love. They're looking for a love that will last. They are looking for a love that will go the distance. Then the question naturally arises, how do you find such a love? I think Solomon tries to provide an answer for us this evening in our text. The answer is by fanning the flames of love. In these verses before us, Solomon, I think, provides for us three different avenues or three different strategies that help us understand how it is that we can fan the flames of love and indeed not only find a love, but keep a love that will last and will go the distance. The first thing he says to do, praise your partner. Verse 15, behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes. Again, the NIV, how beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Praising partners is a constant theme in the Song of Solomon. Why? It is quite clear that from God's perspective, it is an essential ingredient for a healthy marriage. Communication. Communication with kind and gracious words are the currency that buys and builds a lasting love relationship. Again, if I were to sit down and talk with you about the major areas of your marriage that need to be constantly monitored, I would say you must give attention to communication, finances, sex, the rearing of your children, and how you deal with your in-laws. And I would tell you this, if the in-laws gets to be a problem, it'll be because communication broke down. If the rearing of your children or your sex life or your financial life gets in trouble, it will be because communication has broken down. Now, communication is multifaceted, and we need to understand that just as we can build up with positive words, and we talked about that last week, we can also rip to shreds and tear down with negative words. Steve Stevens, again, in commenting on the power of our words, has this to say about our communication with our mate. There is nothing more painful than having unhealthy communication with the one you love. It is through communication that we connect and our spirits touch. And if that connection becomes contaminated, it is only a matter of time before the whole relationship is poisoned. In the process of communication, now listen to this, in the process of communication, wisdom is sometimes knowing what not to say rather than what you should say. And so he gathered together a number of close friends and again asked the reverse question from last week, not what are the kind of things you should say to your mate, but what are the kind of things you ought not to say to your mate, and just listen very quickly to a list that various couples put together. I told you so. You're just like your mother. And guys, that comes from a terminally stupid male mouth, okay? I mean, if you want to have a bad night at the house, if you want to sleep on the couch, if you want to just be miserable, just keep saying, well, you're just like your mother, and you're toast. I mean, you are history as far as having any happiness in that relationship, I assure you, all right? But they continue. You're always in a bad mood. You just don't think. It's your fault. What's wrong with you? All you ever do is complain. I can't do anything to please you. You get what you deserve. Why don't you ever listen to me? Can't you be more responsible? What were you thinking? You're impossible. I don't know why I put up with you. I can talk to you until I'm blue in the face, and it doesn't do any good. I can do whatever I like. If you don't like it, you can just leave. Can't you do anything right? That was stupid. All you ever do is think of yourself. If you really loved me, you'd do this. You're such a baby. Turnabout's fair play. You deserve a dose of your own medicine. What's your problem? I can never understand you. Do you always have to be right? Folks, with words like that, we don't bless, we curse, we don't build up, we tear down, and we do irreparable damage to our marriage. That's why Solomon over and over and over, and the Shulamite woman over and over and over throughout these eight chapters praise one another. They understood the importance of words. In essence, what we are going to see in this passage this evening is that they continue their contest to see who can outpraise and who can outcompliment the other. What a wonderful contest for any husband and wife to engage in their relationship. So you praise your partner. Now, does Solomon have any particulars in mind? As a matter of fact, he has three. Number one, admire their attractiveness. We see there in verse 15, how beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Twice in this verse, Solomon tells his bride, she is beautiful. The New King James says, how beautiful or how fair you are, my love. But that same phrase is translated by the NIV, my darling. And this is not the first time, as we know, that Solomon has complimented her. It will not be the last time. Perhaps what we need to understand is simply this. Saying something nice about our mate and even complimenting our mate about their appearance once is not enough. I remember in thinking through this several years ago as I was studying through the Song of Solomon and picking up on this reoccurring theme of praise and of praising their physical appearance and of also telling them repeatedly that you love them. And I asked Charlotte, I said, honey, could I just maybe tell you too often that I love you? Is it possible that I would say it so much that you would get tired of it? And is it possible that I could compliment you so much that it would lose its value and lose its meaning and it would not, you know, really speak to your heart? And she said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You could never tell me too much that you love me. And you could never tell me too often that you think I'm pretty. And so admiring their attractiveness, how beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. And then he adds at the end of verse 15, you have eyes like a dove. Beautiful eyes were a perfection or were a hallmark of perfection in a woman. Remember the contest between Rachel and Leah in Genesis chapter 29 and verse 17 and the emphasis upon the fact that one had beautiful eyes and the other did not. In fact, the rabbis identified beautiful eyes with a beautiful personality. Now, most Bible scholars, in looking at this particular designation, when it says you have the eyes of a dove, say that what he was saying is your eyes have a gentleness. Your eyes have a tranquility. There is a purity and simplicity to your eyes that when I look in them, I myself am calmed and I myself am encouraged. And as I look into your eyes, I have the ability to look into your soul and I like what I see. Now, folks, let me remind you of something tonight. Outside of your mouth, the most powerful device you have for communication to other persons, the eyes. The eyes. You know, you can take your children, and just by the way you look at them, you can communicate to them. You can look at your children, and your eyes can say something like this. If you do that again, you're dead meat. If you do that again, your life will come to an abrupt end like right now, and you don't have to say anything. The eyes say it all. Or you may look at your children, look at your mate, and by the way you look at them, your eyes say, you know, I love you. I'm so glad God gave you to me. When we lived in Dallas, we were a member of a church, and I don't mean to be unkind tonight, but there was a lady in our church that any night there was a full moon in Dallas, you could see her circling the city on her broom. I mean, she was a broom-riding, cauldron-stirring witch. She's just a mean woman. And so she'd come to church, and it'd just make you nervous as a cat to be around her. And you know what? She would always smile, and she would always grin. And you know, to the best of our ability, we always tried to be kind and nice to her, because you're supposed to be nice and act like Jesus even when you don't want to. And so we would always try to do that. And I remember one Sunday we had been talking to her, and afterwards, we got in our van to go home. When we did, one of the twins, I don't remember if it was Nathan or Jonathan, they were only about 7 or 8 at that time, one of them came up to the front of the van, and they said, Daddy, you know that woman that you and Mama were talking to? I said, yes. They said, she scares me. I said, she scares me too. No, I didn't. No, I didn't. I thought about it. The thought did cross my mind, but I did the right daddy thing, and I said, really? Why does she scare you? And here's what they said. They said, well, Daddy, she smiles with her face, but she has some real mean eyes. I want to tell you something. Her eyes spoke louder than her words. And her eyes betrayed the real person behind them, because your eyes indeed are windows into your soul. And so what is Solomon saying? Solomon's saying, when I look at you, you smile not just with your face. You're not beautiful just with your face, but you are also beautiful with your eyes. I see a beauty on the outside, but by looking into your eyes, I also see a beauty on the inside. And so she admires her attractiveness. Now in verse 16, she returns the favor. Verse 16, behold, now the woman is speaking. You are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant. And also our bed is green, and the beams of our house are cedar, and our rafters of fir. I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valley. Now notice the first part of verse 16. Behold, you are handsome, my beloved. Yes, you are pleasant. Now it's interesting to note, the word handsome is the exact same word in Hebrew that in verse 15 is translated fair or beautiful. The only difference is that, and you can do this in both the Hebrew and Greek language, whereas the word beautiful in 15 is in the feminine gender, the word translated handsome in verse 16 is in the masculine gender. In other words, she uses the exact same word for him that he has just used for her. And it's also interesting to note that word occurs 14 times in the Song of Solomon, and this is the only time it occurs in the masculine. Furthermore, there's an intensity to the word. She uses an intensive form. You yourself truly are handsome, my beloved. Yes, you are pleasant. So she speaks, first of all, of his physical appearance. You're handsome. I find you attractive. But then secondly, she talks about the effect that he has on her, and he says, you're pleasant. You calm me. You put me at rest. You set my heart at peace. Now, that's an odd combination for men. You may find a man that is good-looking, but he acts like a jerk. Or you may find a man that is a gracious, wonderful personality, but he's not very good-looking. Here, she gets the total package. Or at least, I would say it this way. That's how she saw him. That's how he appeared to her. She found him both physically and personally attractive. She is impressed by this man who understands her. She is impressed by this man who has spoken to her heart. She is impressed by this man who has met her at her deepest need. Remember, throughout the first two chapters, she is struggling somewhat with her physical appearance. Back in chapter 1, she says, I'm dark but lovely. And then she says, but I didn't give the attention to my body that I should have because I was forced to work outdoors. And Solomon turns around and says, look, let me tell you something. I find you irresistible. I find you beautiful. I find you incomparable. You are utterly unique. Indeed, I don't find any woman on the planet who even comes close to approaching your beauty. I find you absolutely irresistible. So they admire their attractiveness. Now, secondly, they acknowledge their thoughtfulness. For in verse 16, the latter part in verse 17, she says, our bed is, or our couch is green or verdant, and the beams of our house are cedar, and our rafters are made of fir. Our bed, our couch is green, the beams of our house are cedar, our rafters are fir. Now the first thing I would point out is this, three times she uses the word our. Not yours, not mine, our. His thoughtfulness in preparing a home for them has brought to her a sense of solidarity as well as a sense of security. And I like this that I found out about the word translated there, bed or couch. John Snaith in his commentary writes, and I quote, our couch denotes in Amos 6:4 particularly stylish and magnificent couches used for feasting. Therefore, the couch here is not any old bed. In other words, Solomon is being a rather unusual male, and he is being very specific. He is being very particular in the way that he plans and prepares as they look forward to their wedding day. And as a result of this, she feels a great sense of security. There is a strength, a sturdiness, a safety, a security to this bed and this home that they're going to have. But she says, our bed or our couch is green. Now, why is she saying that? Well, some people think she is talking about not a literal bed or a literal couch, but rather they're out in the courtyard. They're out in the vineyards, and she is looking at the grass and so on. But I don't think so. I think rather she is looking at their wedding bed. And I think what she's saying is, this is going to be a place that's green. What does that mean? A place that's alive. A place where there's life. Our bed is going to be a fruitful place, a fresh place, an alive place. It will be a place of unbelievable activity and growth. Our bed, as you have prepared it, our home, as you have prepared it, is going to be very conducive for the romance and the lovemaking and the passion that God says is a good thing when it comes to the marriage bed. And so he has made marvelous preparation, and she acknowledges his thoughtfulness. But then number three, we should also affirm their uniqueness. It is the Shulamite woman who speaks in verse 1 of chapter 2. I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. Then Solomon adds to that in verse 2 and says, like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. Now, what is being said here? Well, generally speaking, she feels this about herself. And he says, girl, you got it right. You're unique. You're rare. You're special. And the praise or the battle of praise continues. Now, let's break these terms down quickly. Rose of Sharon is more accurately a wildflower. That would be actually a more fair translation. It really is not talking about a rose as you and I would think of it, but rather it is talking about a wild autumn flower that grew in the area of Sharon. Sharon was the low coastal plain which stretched all the way from Mount Carmel in the north all the way down to the Egyptian border in the south. Wild flowers grew in abundance here. Furthermore, the phrase lily of the valley probably refers to a lovely white blossom that had both six leaves and six petals. And Paige Patterson, in his commentary on Song of Solomon, notes this flower was especially associated with nuptial occasions. In other words, because Solomon has said, "You're beautiful," Shulamite now sees herself as beautiful. But she gets rather descriptive, does she not? She says, "Look, I'm not a cultivated flower. I'm a beautiful wildflower. I am free, and I don't think I'm reading into the text. I am untamed by any gardener. No one has ever cultivated this unpicked flower. This flower has maintained its wildness and its untamedness for one person and one person alone, and that is you." In other words, only one man will pick this flower, and only one man will enjoy the refreshment that this flower can bring. And so she sees herself in this kind of unique way, and at the same time, she kind of can let herself go because she feels so secure in the love relationship that they have. Well, she says, "I'm a rose of Sharon. I am the lily of the valleys." And Solomon takes it even a step further, picking up on the idea of the lily. And he says, "Well, like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters." Now, folks, this simply reinforces the imagery that is already there. But I want to tell you what, I find it comical. Now, if you are any woman other than Shulamite, you're not going to like what he says, because basically says this: look, you're a flower, and all other women are thorns. I find you attractive. Every other woman I find to be nothing more than a pain. In other words, you I find attractive. Every other woman I find totally unattractive. In other words, you're like an only flower in a world of thorny weeds. Now, such praise would not cause other women to applaud, but such praise would cause the Shulamite woman to adore this man who loves her in this kind of special and precious way. He affirms her uniqueness. So we first praise our partner, but now secondly, we proclaim their provision, and we do so in two ways. First of all, we tell others how they protect us. And then secondly, we tell others how they please us. Verse 3, "Like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste." Now, yes, folks, I acknowledge. Verse 3 is very specific, and it's very sensual. The passion of love, in one sense, is beginning to run full throttle. Solomon has praised the Shulamite woman in such a way that she now must return the praise, and she does so again with freedom and an unreserved abandonment. Solomon, the man, has created an atmosphere of romance. Solomon has focused not on her negatives or her weaknesses or her shortcomings, but rather he is focused on her strengths. He is focused on her positive features. He has looked for ways to praise her, and her response, it is absolutely nothing short of awesome. She says, first of all, "You protect me." An apple tree in the woods would have been very rare, something totally unexpected. Of course, the apple tree would be sweet to the taste, and the apple tree would provide needed sustenance for the strength and well-being of a person. Solomon said, "You're like the only woman among a bunch of thorns." Shulamite says, "You're like an only apple tree amongst a common wood forest." In other words, all the trees look the same except for you. All the other trees are just boring, ho-hum. There's nothing spectacular. There's nothing interesting. There's nothing about them that would attract me. And then all of a sudden, I walk upon you, and you stand out like the only apple tree in the woods. Again, what a marvelous way that she praises him. And then she says, "Because of this, I will sit down in your shade with great delight, and your fruit was indeed sweet to my taste." This means that she is comforted by him. This means that she is protected by him. I was thinking of the song that used to be sung. They had a little lyric that went something like this. I never knew love before, then came you. And I don't think that would be exaggerating what the Shulamite woman is saying to Solomon. I really never knew love before. No man ever took my heart like you have. I never knew love before, then came you. So she tells others how he protects her. But then secondly, she tells others how he pleases her. He says, you are like an apple tree. Well, apples were believed by some of the ancient world to be an aphrodisiac. They had sensual and erotic qualities. Because she is safe and because she is secure in this relationship, she now says, I long for the physical expressions of love. I long to be intimate with you. I long for lovemaking and sexual union. His fruit was sweet to my taste. Now, folks, notice the language here is chaste and appropriate. The language is not lewd. It is not out of bounds, but it is suggestive and it is sensual. What she is saying is, what I see, I like. What I taste, I like. What I smell, I like. What I feel, I like. And what I like, I want more and more and more of it. Again, Willard Harley got it right when he said to men, romance is an environment which you must create. And in the environment of romance, sexual union takes place more often, and sexual union takes place with a higher degree of satisfaction. But you must cultivate the environment of romance and affection. Solomon has done that. And again, her response is absolutely nothing but spectacular. Now, we've kind of come to the edge of this whole issue of sex. And just what are God's thoughts on this? If you'll take the outline for just a moment, I want to just kind of dovetail for just a moment very quickly and talk about the fact that God, who is a big fan of sex, after all, He thought it up, He gave it to us, has also given us some biblical principles that are to govern our sex life as well. I think you will find these supported throughout Song of Solomon, but you also find these in Proverbs and especially in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 as well. So note with me very quickly these seven or eight principles. Number one, sex relations within marriage are holy and good. God encourages intimate relations and even warns against their cessation, 1 Corinthians 7, 5. Number two, pleasure in sexual relations is both healthy and expected. The bodies of both parties now belong to each other. Number three, sexual pleasure is to be guided by the principle that one's sexuality, now this is so important, and especially for a man, one's sexuality is to be other-oriented. Rights over one's body are given in marriage to the other party. Number four, sex relations are to be regular and normal. Now, the Bible, no exact number of times per week is right or correct, but the biblical principle is that both parties are to provide adequate sexual satisfaction so that both burning sexual desire and temptation to find satisfaction elsewhere are avoided. Number five, the principle of satisfaction means that each party is to provide sexual enjoyment, which is due him or her in marriage, as frequently as the other party requires. Now, don't stop there. Other biblical principles, such as moderation, and this one ought to be underlined, seeking to please another rather than oneself, also come into play. Consideration of one's mate is to guide one's request for sexual relations. Number six, in accordance with the principle of rights, there is to be no sexual bargaining between married persons. I'll not have relations unless you, and then you fill in the blank. Neither party has the right to make such bargains. And this metaphor is strong, but it's accurate. This is a form of marital prostitution. To play, you must pay. And folks, that absolutely must be aborted. Number seven, sex relations are equal and reciprocal. The Bible does not give the man superior rights to the woman or the woman superior rights to the man. Mutual stimulation and mutual initiation of relations are legitimate. And number eight, and this one is especially important, whatever is safe, pleasing, enjoyable and satisfying to both, is acceptable. The body of each belongs to the other. 1 Corinthians 7:4. Neither should demand from the other what is painful, harmful, degrading, or distasteful to him or her. And those are principles that I think we indeed find as mates talk about proclaiming their provision for one another. Now, number three, how do we fan the flames of love? We also prepare for passion. Verse 4, he brought me into the house of wine, the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me then with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Now, in the outline that you have, I've given you three subpoints here. Number one, we should make love in the right place. Number two, we should make love in the right way. And number three, we should make love at the right time. I've actually added a fourth one as I was working through the text again this week, and it will be a second point that I will add. So first of all, we are to make love in the right place. As I mentioned a moment ago, the banqueting house literally means the house of wine. I believe that we are now anticipating the wedding night. Now understand me, I do take the view that everything up to chapter 3, verses 6 to 11 is the courtship. I think they're courting. I think they're dating. I think they're getting ready. There's no debate. No debate. The wedding is described in chapter 3, verses 6 to 11. There's no debate. The wedding night is described in chapter 4, verse 1 through chapter 5, verse 1. So the question becomes, well, what about some of these things we read about in chapter 1, 2, and 3. Boy, they sound very suggestive. They sound very sensual. They sound like they're involved in the act of intimacy. And yes, I think it sounds that way because there are times where in their passion and in their thought life, they jump ahead. So in other words, I think what you have here is an anticipation of what is yet to come. They are anticipating the wedding night. They're anticipating the love that is just around the corner. Now, what is the meaning then of the text that he brings me into the banqueting house, the house of wine? Well, it's simply this. Within the bonds of marriage, within the bonds of that wedding, sex relations are to be enjoyed. As we have seen, wine is intoxicating. It can overcome you, and therefore, within the bonds of marriage, God says, this is a good thing. This is a proper thing. I am indeed in favor of it. He says, he brought me into the banqueting house. He brought me, not another or not others. It is exclusive. It is reserved only for them. Therefore, in the sanctity and privacy of the wedding bed, there you find the right place. But now, secondly, and this is not in your outline, we should also make love with the right commitment. The right commitment. It says there also in verse 4, his banner over me is love. This speaks of the protective love of her lover and the safe place to which he has brought her. Furthermore, this is something of a public announcement. This is something of a public declaration. He is not afraid nor fearful nor hesitant to proclaim to the world his love for this woman. And furthermore, I find in this text a consistency. This man treats her privately the same way he treats her publicly. There's not one treatment in one place and another treatment in the other. In other words, he's not warm and considerate when they're alone, but cold and sarcastic when they are with others. He is not ashamed of his love for her, and he is glad for all to know of it. Now, that last phrase there, his banner over me is love, is a difficult phrase to translate in Hebrew. And in fact, Carr, in his commentary, says that actually a better translation in his judgment is, and his wish regarding me was lovemaking. Or more simply, his intentions toward me were to make love. Now, whichever reading is correct, what we do know is this. There is the right commitment. They are committed to one another and one another only. Solomon wants only her, and she wants only him. Therefore, they are the right partners. They have the right passion. They're in the right place. But there are two more ingredients that still need to be added before everything is right. Number three, you must also make love in the right way. Shulamite describes herself as if she were in the midst of a great banquet, a great feast, as she thinks about their lovemaking. I believe her mind is carried away as she anticipates the joys of their marriage, which is about to occur. And indeed, both in Song of Solomon and Proverbs, the Bible uses the metaphor or the picture of feasting. And the Bible says within marriage, it's good for a man to feast on his wife, and it's good for a woman to feast on her husband. And God smiles when we do. And so she thinks about this, and basically she nearly passes out. The New King James is a bit weak here. It says, "Sustain me with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick." One person said, "I myself am swooning in the rapture of the moment, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to keep standing up." So what does she say? Time out, I want to stop. Time out, this is too much for me. Oh no, she says, "This is good. I like this." And so, sustain me, it's an imperative in the Hebrew text, with cakes of raisins. Refresh me, it's an imperative, with apples. And again, cakes of raisins and apples were both viewed in the ancient world as that which encouraged sensual love expression between a man and a woman. Now, she is indeed caught up in the passion of the moment. But at the same time, she can do so. Why? Guys, why? Because of the security she feels. Look at verse 6. "His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me." It's interesting to note that word "embraced" is used in the Old Testament both of a friendly greeting, Genesis 48:10, and of sexual union, Proverbs 5 and 20. In other words, what is she saying? But he is both my friend and my lover. And again, gentlemen, both of those things are important to any and every woman. Finally, number four, we're to make love at the right time. Verse 7 is such an important verse in the Song of Solomon. It occurs three times at strategic locations. Here in chapter 2, verse 7, again in chapter 3, verse 5, and a third time in chapter 8, verse 4. Why? Because God wants us to understand that sex relations should take place at the right place, with the right person, in the right way, and at the right time. In other words, not any time is a good time. Not any time is a proper time. Not any time is a right time. There is indeed a proper time, a God time, and verse 7 makes that clear. "Do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases." This is so important that the Shulamite woman voices this in the form of an oath. "I charge you, I adjure you, I encourage you or urge you by the gazelles or by the does of the field." Both female animals, beautiful, vigorous, sexually active, and so she calls upon them as she adjures, as she urges, as she charges the what I call the sorority of females, for she says, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem." In other words, women, listen. Women, listen. We should pursue passion, but do it at the proper pace and at the proper place. The Shulamite woman understands that though it is normally the man who is viewed as the sexual creature and the one who is occupied more often than not with sexual thoughts, she says, but wait a minute. Women are sexual beings too. And women have feelings and emotions and passions too. And God made us to be active sexual beings too. But all of us, men and women alike, are susceptible to our passions getting out of control. We are susceptible to our passions overriding our reason, our will, and our good judgment. And when it does, it can cause massive hurt and enormous damage. Therefore, never forget, God gave us sex as a wonderful gift and a gift to be enjoyed, but enjoyed when? Within the bonds of marriage. God's plan is the same today, yesterday, and forever. He is not trying to rain on our parade. He is not trying to cramp our style or steal our fun. He gave us this plan both to give Himself glory, and He gave us this plan because He knew it was for our good. Dwayne Garrett, in his commentary on Song of Solomon, says, and I quote, "The girls should not allow themselves to be aroused sexually until the proper time and person arrives. The natural joy of sexual awakening is ruined by premature experimentation." So what?